Well, I hope so, because I was one of those who was praising him, so among all the living, perhaps. They searched the night skies every evening for what must have seemed like ages, and it may well have been that their ancestors had, in fact, scanned those skies for almost that long. They were looking for something special, a sign in the skies from God, a signal from him that he was doing something significant in his world, that he was starting to intervene on earth once again, as he had in the time of Moses. Then they found what they were looking for. Excitedly, they shared their discovery with their associates. Anxiously, they packed their bags for a long journey. The sign, a very different light in the skies, was moving. It was as if it was urging them on, leading them to where God himself had personally stepped into history. So just who were these observers, ancient observers of the night skies? And why were they even searching so intently for that special light that would serve as God's sign? Before getting to the answers to these questions, some important historical context is essential. A couple years ago, I wrote in one of our newsletters, as we light and see the Hanukkah candles during the season, we're reminded of its lessons. Because the Maccabees were committed to following God, the light that the Jewish people brought to the world could continue to shine. Remember, we were designated to be a light to the world. What Judah and his brothers accomplished then made it possible 160 years later for some wise men from the east to follow the light that led them to the newborn light of the world. In fact, the celebration of the arrival of the wise men on January 6th is called Epiphany, the Festival of Light, or in some cases, the Festival of Lights. It's called that by some parts of the world, and it reflects a very ancient historical tradition. End quote. Now, we are concluding what I designated last year at this time, then I designated it as the beginning, of a year of uncommon convergences. For example, last year, Easter and Purim coincided. Shabbat and Pesach coincided. And those were just a couple of probably, at least half a dozen, if not something in double figures, uncommon convergences. And then sort of conclude that year. I know it's a little more than a year. Epiphany, the festival of light or lights, is on Shabbat. Let me translate that for you. In other words, on this very night, some 2,000 plus years ago, 2021 if you want to be exact, years ago, on this very night, the star hovered over that home in Bethlehem. And the wise men saw it. Now, part of the convergence is also that we read about the unique birth of Moses. And I want to get back to it in just a minute. We read about the burning bush when God speaks to Moses and tells him a little more about his name. And please remember what God's name means. It's not for tonight. We've done this before. God's name, the name that is no longer pronounced and is in all likelihood unpronounceable, because we don't know how to pronounce it, means, I will be with you. Let me translate that for you in another way. Emmanuel. Now, regarding the birth of Moses, and I'll let you reflect on that for just a second, and I'm quoting now from a book called The New Testament and Rabbinic Judaism, by, I was going to say former, he's not just former, he's also late, unfortunately, primary scholar of Judaic studies at Oxford University, David Dalby. He writes, a passage in Leviticus Rabbah, that's the Midrash, has reference to Moses' birth as a result of a direct generation by the Lord himself, and so it connects with the virgin birth. You see, the reference to our affliction in Deuteronomy 26:7 was interpreted in the Midrash on the Passover to mean the voluntarily enforced abstention from sexual intercourse, which Israel endured at the Exodus. And then the Midrash takes the phrase, "and God knew," to refer to actual physical intervention by God himself, who thus directly secured the birth of Moses personally. End quote. I didn't make that up. That's built on the Midrash. Therefore, what it's talking about is a supernatural birth for Moses without sexual relations. And then I want you to notice further the very precise phrasing that's found in the Talmud itself concerning Moses' birth. Listen to how the Talmud phrases it. "And the woman conceived and bore a son." Does that sound familiar? Yeah, it ought to. From two places, not only in Levi's Gospel, but also from Isaiah 7. ...2021 years ago, that star in the sky stopped over Bethlehem. Well, as it turns out, if you read in both the Talmud and in the Midrash, at the birth of Moses, his birthplace was flooded by light as well. That's part of this week's Parsha. But back to the wise men and how they got there. Now, a couple of years ago, in fact, about the same time as I wrote that newsletter for Menorah Ministries, I got a newsletter for somebody else. And I want to quote from that newsletter. "When we consider Christmas heroes, Joseph, Mary, the wise men, and the shepherds immediately come to mind. For me, one of the great overlooked Christmas heroes is the prophet Daniel." Why Daniel? Daniel is the only Old Testament prophet to predict the timing of the Messiah's coming, Daniel 9. An angel, well, angels get into this scene often, don't they? An angel told Daniel how many years would transpire between the decree to rebuild Jerusalem and the Messiah's arrival. The angel's visit raises a question. Why Daniel and nobody else? Three times the angel explains that Daniel was highly esteemed. Daniel's wisdom and trustworthiness were so great that two of the most powerful emperors who ever lived both made him prime minister over their realms. What made these appointments remarkable, and in fact unprecedented in human history, was that these emperors ruled kingdoms that were at war with one another. God used Daniel to bring his message to the most powerful rulers and through them to their citizens. Consequently, Daniel greatly influenced not only his own generation, but also all subsequent generations. Quick pause. So may it be with us. Back to the end of the quote. As the wisest, godliest, and most trusted of all wise men, or magi, Daniel influenced the wise men who lived at the time of Christ's birth. So great was the respect these magi had for Daniel that based on less than 100 words of his prophecy, they launched a major expedition to seek out the newborn Messiah and present him gifts that guaranteed his survival, end quote. These searchers that Daniel influenced, just who were they? Well, the text calls them, depending on your translation, magi from the east, or wise men. Quick aside, when it says in the east, as Dr. Patrice would be happy to point out to you, it's not the star that was in the east, it was they who were in the east who saw the star. Fair enough? In other words, as the text says, these were magi or wise men from the east. And as a result, I'm sure they had great wisdom. Wisdom that they would have shared with others. For example, running aluminum foil through the paper shredder to make tinsel is discouraged. Thank you. Eggnog should not be dispensed in vending machines. Or work requests should not be filed under bah humbug. Well, I'm sorry, that's the wrong list. But seriously, concerning the Magi, the term itself often implies astrologers, but in this particular context, it really means religious astronomers. You see, their study of the heavens was part of their worship of God. And that makes sense. Psalm 19, verse 1, David tells us, the heavens, in fact, declare or express the glory of God. And as I said, they were from the east, possibly as far east as Persia. Now, Persia took over the Babylonian Empire, the place of captivity for the Jewish people. However, most Jews remained in that area of the empire, which is why we get a Talmud that's called the Babylonian Talmud. Why would it be called the Babylonian Talmud, he asks? Because much of the scholarship related to it were from the scholars, Jewish scholars, who were still in. Yeah, Babylon. Okay. In fact, some scholars have speculated that these magi, the wise men, were in fact Jews. And I would concur with that, by the way. In this case, I think they're correct. Moreover, the recently uncovered Kinkar-Brace text of a Hebrew version of Matthew has an alternate reading describing the Magi, and the term is machnim. Machnim. Believers. Believers. Either way, Daniel and Esther were both part of the Persian courts. And Persia, not surprisingly, had a rich and diversified religious history. In fact, Daniel had been the head of the Magi in that court. Which then raises the corollary question, now just what did they, the Magi, know? Well, they knew two important things, and this comes from their very mouths. They knew that the king of the Jews had been born. That's in Persia. And they knew, secondly, that his star had appeared. Question, so how could they have known about the Jewish king while they were in Persia? And how did they know to look for a star of some sort as the sign, and why for that special star? Well, let me suggest some people had obviously heard, paid attention to, and remembered Daniel, Esther, and Mordecai, to Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. And they may have heard of the faithfulness of the God of Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. You remember the three who ended up in the fiery furnace. And they may well still have been aware of the ancient prophecies of Ezekiel. In other words, the lives and words of these people of God had sunk in, and so the wise men came. Another challenge for us. Do our lives and words have the same kind of impact? Oh, that's getting intrusive, so let me ask another question. And why did they come? Well, they tell you, to quote them, quote their words, to worship the newborn king. You see, they knew the significance of the events they were participating in. For example, the stuff we sang about in Lakat Odi. Arise, shine, what does it say? Your light has come. Does that sound familiar? Right at the heart of Lakat Odi. And the glory of the Lord rises on you. See, darkness covers the earth and thick darkness. This is Isaiah 60. And thick darkness is over the peoples. But the Lord rises upon you. That reminds me of Malachi 4, verse 2. The Son of Righteousness rises, S-U-N, of righteousness, rises with healing in his wings. Isaiah 60 goes on to say, and his glory appears over you. Keep listening. Nations will come to your light. Kings to the brightness of your dawn. Camels will come bearing gold and incense, proclaiming the praise of the Lord. So said Isaiah. These people, the wise men, knew the significance of the events. These people, the Magi, they knew the importance of the child that they were searching for. As Isaiah reminds us even earlier, chapter 9 this time, "Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the future, he will honor Galilee of the Gentiles." Galilee. Nazareth, key city there. "The people walking in darkness will have seen" what? "A great light. On those living in the shadow of death, a light has dawned." And what is that light? Or what is connected with that light? Exactly 4 verses later. "Unto us a child is born. Unto us a son is given." Yeah, they knew. Raising the question, do we? In other words, in the hubbub of the holidays that has transpired, and amidst the uproar of the myths regarding the so-called pagan roots of this holiday, did we miss the significance of the events? Do we forget the importance of the child? As they did, do we worship him? Do we bow to serve him? Theoretically, we will do so during the Elenu. We'll also reflect on the time when every knee will bow before him, from Isaiah 45. What did the Magi do? They literally bowed before him, setting an example for us. And now, back to the star for a second, the star that guided them. Many years before, a king by the name of Balak, king of Moab, was alarmed. So he called for this prophet called Balaam. He was nicknamed the donkey rider. That's not quite what his nickname was, but we'll leave it there. The text says he was from Petor, near the river. What's the river? The Euphrates. Just located for you geographically. And he was asked to curse Israel. And what was the result? Think back with me 2 weeks when I last addressed you. The result was clearly this: eucatastrophe. And if you don't remember eucatastrophe, the recording is available. And out of his mouth came these words: "A scepter will rise out of Israel." In other words, a ruler will come out of Israel. Sound like King of the Jews? Yeah, for sure. He says, "A star will come out of Jacob." Sound like his star? The Magi we're looking for? By the way, that's part of God's promised blessings on Jacob. He keeps blessing Jacob, unlike some of the people who teach about him. Anyhow, what did Balaam do after this? Undoubtedly, he returned home. Where? Beyond the Euphrates. He shared the experience, and he shared about the prophecy. And it apparently became part of the folklore of the East. Friends, the wise men, the Magi, would certainly have known the ancient traditions. That was part of their job. When the Jewish people in captivity talked of and longed for their Messiah, the wise men would have made the connection and investigated further prophecies. And especially so when they made the connection with the legacy of Daniel. So back to the question, how did the wise men know when to search the skies? Well, Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 27 talks about the time of his coming and talks about the coming of the one whom he calls the Anointed One. Hebrew term, real difficult one to translate, Mashiach. And then describes him as the ruler. Remember, Daniel served as the head magi in the royal court of Persia. Therefore, the wise men would have known the history and the exploits of Daniel, and they would have remembered his words. Okay? So when did Daniel predict this special he would come? Well, that's part of the insert in the bulletin. I spend a lot more time on this in a couple of the classes, so I'm just going to very briefly summarize with you what you've got in front of you. The 70 weeks of Daniel gives us a starting point, point A. It's the command to rebuild Jerusalem. From the texts that are listed there, we find it's the seventh year of Artaxerxes. For your benefit, I looked this up for you. 458 BCE, before the Common Era. It talks about 70-year weeks, or weeks of years, the intervening time between the starting point and the end point. I've multiplied that out for you. It's 483 years. And then the end point, Z, is the arrival on the scene of the Messiah, functioning as the Messiah. In other words, just as in ancient Jewish tradition, at 30 years old, when he's supposed to step into his ministry. I've worked a year out for you there. It's 26 of the Common Era. By the way, history tells us he died in the year 30 after a ministry of 3.5 years. If you're doing your addition, that means he did arrive on the scene, as Daniel predicted, in the year 26. That's how they knew when to begin to look for him. So the wise men searched the skies, and when they found what they were looking for, they came to the king. And tradition tells us that they arrived on what we call on our calendar January 6th, or Epiphany. That's tonight, friends. It celebrates, historically, the arrival of the wise men. If you calculate the distance they would have to travel, they would have arrived just under 2 weeks after they first saw the star, or in this case, 12 days. And this tradition is upheld by many of the earlier forms of what is called Christian tradition. And remember, it's called the Festival of Lights. We have a Festival of Lights, too. And the Haftorah for the week after the Festival of Lights is Ezekiel chapter 37, verses 15 to 28. Now, let me remind you in about three sentences about Ezekiel. Ezekiel was taken into captivity and prophesied in Babylon. He was a unique prophet, who saw and spoke of strange things and, in fact, lived or acted them out, as he did with his other messages. Therefore, undoubtedly, this prophet would have left a lasting impression. He would have made a significant impact on his time. And certainly the stories about this strange prophet would have persisted even outside Jewish circles. The wise men would clearly have known the tradition. And in that text, in verses 24 and 25, Ezekiel says, "My servant David will be king over them." My servant David will be king over them. Interesting text. By the way, this Haftorah usually falls right around the time of Rosh Chodesh, the new month celebration. Rosh Chodesh is in the anticipation of David's heir, the Messiah. As Psalm 89 says, as God promised, "I have sworn to David that his dynasty will go on forever. It will be eternal as the moon." Given our historical context, listen to this. "My faithful witness," where? In the sky. Like the Jewish people, the rest of the Jewish people, the wise men were expecting the king from David's line, from his dynasty, the king of the Jews. And they had a very good idea of when to expect him, and they knew where to look for him. So appropriately, as we read a couple weeks ago, as we lit the Chanukiah, the light that lights the others is called the Shamash, or servant candle. It gives light to all the others, John 1:9. It reminds us, as does the daily Amidah, which we prayed, as we look for the lengthening of the light of the Messiah, Yeshua himself. He entered our history as a baby, accompanied by that heavenly light that guided the Magi one Hanukkah evening many centuries ago. And so we can enthusiastically respond, we said, as is customary on Hanukkah, "Nes Gadol Chaya Sham." Nes Gadol Chaya Sham. A great miracle happened there. As one author reminded us, and I quote, "On earth, a baby was born. A king got wind of it. A chase ensued. In heaven, the great invasion had begun. A daring raid by the ruler of the forces of good into the universe's seat of evil. End quote. Nicely said. Remember those couple newsletters I quoted from? I got the following from a newsletter from Denver Seminary, where I occasionally teach. And this comes from one of their faculty members, Darlene Seal. You know, often we long for some tangible manifestation of God's care for us. The incarnation is God's answer to that need. This is not a God who stands at a distance and lectures us when we fall. This is not a God who holds us at arm's length. This is a God who lowered himself to raise us up. End quote. It, of course, was a Christmas reflection. By the way, as the Canadian author John Williams so nicely put it for us, this is he whose command, talking about this one, this is he whose command fashioned unnumbered galaxies. To him belong the cattle on 100,000 hills, and his is the wealth in every mine. Yet this glorious one became poor. How poor? When he was born, they loaned him an animal's feeding trough for a bed. At his presentation in the temple, his family could offer only a couple of pigeons. In adult life, he had no home, nowhere to lay his head, except the ground he had made. When he needed a penny, quick aside, probably closer to a dime, but we'll leave it as he put it. When he needed a penny, he had to borrow one. He died a criminal's death, and they buried him in a borrowed tomb. That's what he came to do for us. So now, in light of all this, what should we be doing? Now, this goes back not just a couple of years. It's to an email that Dr. Patrice sent me about 20 years ago. She said, a person on my listserv sent this. I think it's very appropriate, and I think she's very right. When the song of the angels is stilled, when the star in the sky is gone, when the kings and princes are home, when the shepherds are back with their flocks, then the work of Christmas begins. Namely, and she's addressing us, to find the lost, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among the people, and, I love this, and to make music in the heart. And I close with the words of yet another wise man. He summarized it quite eloquently and very recently. It was in Doctor Who's Christmas special from last month. To quote the good doctor, hate is always foolish. Love is always wise. May we join with the wise men of old. Take a minute or so for a time of reflection and the beginning of a response.